The Cambridge Marketing Podcast with Kiran Kapoor. Brought to you by Cambridge Marketing College. See their range of courses and apprenticeships at marketingcollege.com.
Hello and welcome. Today, a look at some more unusual marketing organisations, a charity, a public service, and an estate agency. We start with the East Sussex Fire and Rescue Service, and Elizabeth Curtis explains what customers mean to a public service.
I think most people assume when they hear about fire and rescue that it's all about responding to emergencies. When you dial 999, you have an expectation that someone will come and help you. And that is obviously one of our key services that we provide the public, and you could describe it as a product. But we also do a lot of work preventing emergencies. So we do a lot of home safety checks, a lot of business safety checks. Obviously, with COVID, we have had to adjust the way we do that because that used to be face-to-face. And what we've seen is that marketing has sort of come up trumps with reaching people that we would normally engage face to face with. So our marketing channels have changed. If you're talking in those terms, often we talk more about engagement and education. A lot of what we deliver is actually set out in law. So it's very different from a company which is selling a product. There are certain statutory duties we have to fulfill, but it's making sure the public know what those are and how they can access them that's most important.
So that's interesting because you've talked about some products and I want to ask a bit more about that. But isn't what you're really selling a sense of reassurance or a sense of security? So the brand of I can trust a fire and rescue service is really important.
Trust is one of the key points that we know we enjoy. The public do trust us. I think it's interesting when you have got this sort of the two drivers, the public expectations of us and the legal expectations of us. And when you're looking at that, how you fill that space in people's minds about what we're offering is quite fascinating. I think particularly with the tragedy at Grenfell, fire safety has become much more important to a lot of people who perhaps haven't thought about it before. And certainly reassurance is one of those things that they expect us to do. But more and more often, they expect us to take action as well to keep them safe. So it's not just being there and waiting like an insurance policy, but it's actually going out there and making the difference before the bad things happen. And I think when you talk about the branding for all fire and rescue services, we offer the same thing. So while we may be a monopoly in East Sussex and in Brighton Hove, across the whole of the UK, you have different services doing things slightly differently. And we do a lot of work sharing with other communications teams of how they are trying to reach people and to make sure people are aware of the dangers, not just of fires, but road safety, water safety. And some of those messages, you really have to sort of try them out and see how they hit home, because people don't assume it will happen to them and they often don't realise that they can change their future by their own behaviour. And I think that's what attracts me, is this idea of making people realise your destiny is in your own hands a lot of the time. If you can make some small adjustments, you will be safer. So while we're providing, as you say, reassurance, what we'd like to do in the future is be more of the friend that walks beside you and make sure you don't have the accidents in the first place.
It's interesting because I think so often when we hear fire and rescue service, the bit we think about is the fire. So you're rescuing people from a fire, but what you're actually saying is it's a much wider remit around safety.
Yes. I mean, we have a whole range of skills. So road traffic collisions, you sort of commonly known things about the jaws of life, where you cut open a car. Some of those stereotypes are the reality of the work that they do, but often you'll find that they'll be brought, called to a scene to make the scene safe. So it'll be clearing up fuel after a road traffic collision. And so some of it is not exactly the high adrenaline activity you would see in films, but it is very important to keep the world moving safely. We have rope rescue teams, we have training on water safety to make sure that we can reach people who need rescuing from rivers and such like. And we work with a lot of partners who often have a greater skill base in those areas. And we're part of a much wider team. We also have a very good working relationship with the local ambulance service, and we're seeing particularly more rescues requiring our support, so gaining entry to people's homes in order for the ambulance crew and the paramedics to reach them. So it's a whole range of work we do, and perhaps a lot of it goes unnoticed until you need us yourself. I think one of the greatest things that we do, which again is very enjoyable for those involved in it, is going into schools. So we do a lot of education work. But again, that tends to go sort of almost unnoticed because it is not the dramatic side of things that perhaps the news locally will pick up on. So for us, the marketing challenge is often reminding people that we're here and we can offer lots of different support in different ways, and making sure people know how they can get to us. And we do all this on a very small marketing budget. I have about £7,000 a year to cover everything we do, and that's a tough call, but you have to be inventive and you have to lean on other partners to help share messages.
Next, Rowan Waller discusses how the internet has revolutionised marketing for estate agencies.
The thing about estate agency is it's evolved fairly quickly since the advent of the internet. And obviously, when you think about, even now, people, they'll talk about get their details out for when they bought their house, and it's some sort of photocopy bit of paper with a physical photograph that's been cut out and stuck on it, and that was the brochure that they got. And nowadays, obviously, since the internet came along, and then since Rightmove came along very quickly, the industry sort of shifted. So when I became an estate agent, which was 2005, we were getting used to the internet. It hadn't been around so long then. We knew that we needed to be on Rightmove. Trying to think if Zoopla was even around then. I think it was. So I think there was a contender for Rightmove that was sort of coming on the scene. But we were still, as an agency back then, we were still every week thinking about which properties we needed to put in the East Anglian Daily Times or whatever it was. And it was a big deal, and it was an instruction getter, to go out and be able to tell somebody when you're valuing their house that they were going to be in the Evening Star or the East Anglian Daily Times that week. So I think that's what's really changed for me in the last, 16 years, is that I don't know when the last time I particularly mentioned the newspaper adverts was, and it's really not something that you see people doing. And all of the focus when we're talking, when we're competing with each other as estate agents, is about how we're going to present people's houses online.
Okay, so when Rightmove came in, was it seen as something that was going to change things? Can you remember that far back?
No, I'm afraid I'm a spring chicken, because I don't know when Rightmove came about. It certainly existed by the time I became an estate agent. So by the time I was one, 2005, every estate agent, I can't think of any estate, there was no competitor of mine that wasn't on Rightmove. And I think it was still new enough that back then, when we were valuing houses, customers would ask us, will my property be on Rightmove? So I think it was probably new enough that customers worried that they might not be on it, or they were certainly aware of it. But I think that nowadays I think this is the issue that we have. This is a topic of conversation as well, but you wouldn't put your house on the market and expect it to not be on Rightmove. You would assume automatically it was going to be on Rightmove, which is why Rightmove actually has so much power in and over the industry.
How does that power manifest itself?
That power manifests itself year after year in around a 20% fee increase that we struggle to bat away because, you know, with the best will in the world, if we aren't on Rightmove, we would start losing customers. That's the fear that we all have as agents. So when this letter comes through the post saying, you know, we had another great year, and by the way, your fee's going up by 20%, we sort of swallow it and we whinge about it and complain about it, and you'll see it in the industry press. But not a lot's been done about it. Zoopla came along and it was a contender to Rightmove. So a lot of agents were then, you know, dueling on, as in not dueling with pistols, but they were dual marketing, Rightmove and Zoopla. And then another portal came along, which you might know of, which is called On The Market, which was set up by a kind of a cooperative of independent estate agents to create a new portal that would break the duopoly of Rightmove and Zoopla. And it's a, you know, a good idea in theory, but in practice, when that set up, the idea was you could either be, in fact, they might have wanted to set up saying, look, everyone come off Rightmove and Zoopla and come on the market, and we'll, you know, that's how to kill off this, you know, this sort of duopoly that's taken over the industry. And of course, when you got to the coalface, nobody wanted to do that. So then they said, okay, you could be with one or the other, but you can't be with both Rightmove and Zoopla. So you have to drop one and be with On The Market. Now, bear in mind, that wasn't the whole of the market that was doing this. It was mainly independent agents. So all the corporate agents that were tied in with Rightmove or Zoopla didn't have that option. And when it happened, most of the agents dropped Zoopla and did Rightmove and On The Market. And then I think maybe in London it was slightly different. London was a market that Rightmove didn't matter quite so much. So Zoopla was, you know, very effective in London. But outside of London, the picture was agents would drop Zoopla, but they would absolutely stick with Rightmove, and they would go On The Market and Rightmove because of this fear that if they stopped using Rightmove, then they would lose business. So that's
in fact that's how the power manifests. Power.
But you know what, Rightmove provide a very good service, but it's been incredibly clever. Rightmove, I'm not going to badmouth Rightmove because we've got a good relationship. I've got a working relationship with them anyway. But they also sell lots of houses for us. That's how we market, and it's how we sell. So they are correct that without them we would struggle. We would struggle to do business. But there is a truth that actually estate agents have created Rightmove. We've marketed them for 25 years or however long it is they've been around. We've put their logo in our window. We've shouted about it to customers. So we've actually created this beast. And this beast is then working for us. But also, you know, I think people underestimate the sort of fees that we do pay these portals every month. It's, you know, it runs into thousands of pounds when you're on several of them. So it's by far my biggest overhead is the portals, by far, by a long way. It's even more than my office and my rent. In fact, I'm not even sure my staff costs more than my portal costs now that we're across so many of them.
And finally, Thursa McSherry, Director of Marketing and Communications at the Wildlife Trusts, explains how she measures marketing success.
Well, we have a number of campaigns. Our longest running one is something called 30 Days Wild, and that's happening now. Mm-hmm. And it's where we ask members of the public to do something wild, something we call a random act of wildness, every day during the month of June. And we engage around 700,000 people every year in 30 Days Wild, and that's growing. It grew phenomenally last year, and we've seen another jump in that this year as well. And that's people all over the UK taking part in 30 Days Wild, and it was really conceived of as a public engagement campaign to get people just taking a moment to consider the beauty of nature and also the impact on their own health. We did a study with the University of Derby, which demonstrated that people's health and well-being was very positively impacted by taking part in 30 Days Wild, and just noticing nature and taking time in your day to do that actually had a long-term effect on people's well-being as well. And there are numerous studies around the impact of nature on well-being, and it's something that we feel really passionate about at the Wildlife Trust, and we very firmly believe that everybody should have that access to nature wherever they are. And so that's 30 Days Wild. But we also run a number of short-term campaigns dedicated to raising awareness and building support for the changes that we need to see, particularly in our policy landscape. So, for example, we've run campaigns around changes to planning law. Obviously, planning regulations really sort of impacting on nature's recovery, or even, you know, the basic sort of protection of nature in the face of development. We've run campaigns around major infrastructure projects, such as HS2, for example, where our reporting has shown that there are around 100 sites of ancient woodland and special sites for wildlife going to be impacted by the route, and really calling on the public to help us get the changes that we need to see around the HS2 planning. That was one of our sort of biggest campaigns. Actually, we had around 200,000 people really sort of getting their voices heard through that. We've also run campaigns for greater protection around our seas, particularly in respect of, and listeners may have seen government announcement last week on the designation of the first new highly protected marine areas, which will massively reduce the impact of infrastructure and fishing in those areas, and allow our hugely depleted marine life to recover in those protected areas. That has been a very long-term campaign by the Wildlife Trust to see those highly protected marine areas in place. So it was a really momentous occasion for us last week when the government finally made an announcement on the first of those.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask was how you measure success of your campaigns. I mean, clearly something like that, highly protected marine area, the government makes an announcement. I imagine you would, in normal circumstances, throw a wild party because you'd feel that, you know, you massively achieved. But that, as you said, was a long-term campaign. So I suppose there's two parts of the question. One is, how do you keep the momentum going in such a long period of time? And also, how do you measure the success of your campaigns?
Well, you're right. I mean, when you see the sort of changes finally implemented, and you know, that is a huge cause for celebration. That is the ultimate. But beyond that, when you start to see in those areas through monitoring, you know, and research, the wildlife actually recovering, that's, you know, the sort of big goal really. Mm-hmm. But taking it back a few steps, the sorts of things that we look at are the number of people engaging with our campaigns. So we look very carefully at engagements on our social media, for example. We use social listening tools to monitor what people are saying about particular issues. We look at, you know, all your sort of normal things that you would look at through your analytics, such as conversion of people arriving at our campaigns pages, taking action. So just to give you a few examples of this, you know, your sort of standard action might be for people to sign a petition to government. Mm-hmm. They ranging from that to, for example, booking a meeting with their member of parliament to go and talk about a particular issue and having that meeting. So that requires obviously a, you know, a higher level of commitment from a member of the public who's you know, engaged with us to campaign on a particular issue's behalf. But that can often be the most powerful sort of action that somebody can take, going to speak to their MP, or you know, in normal times, obviously going into their surgery and seeing mm-hmm. them. And it's where the Wildlife Trusts are really effective, because, as I mentioned, we're so rooted in those local communities. So a number of individuals going and speaking to their MP, who will then be voting on a certain matter, has a really powerful effect in terms of our campaigning. And the real sort of role of the marketing team within all of that is to create those really smooth supporter journeys. So we work very hard on sort of smoothing out any kind of friction.
And that's all for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to hear those interviews in full, and they really are worth it, just search for Cambridge Marketing Podcasts or go to wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. And I'll catch you next week.